So, having had occasion now to watch 1991's Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves for the first time, I can certify the consensus opinion that Kevin Costner's performance in the lead role, in particular his accent, is infamously bad. So bad, it's iconic. The very performance that accent coaches point to when they ask for pay raises. Look, pay me, or this is the British accent you'll get.
Yes, but I'm free. Now I beg you to free yourself of your vow. Return with the boat. I know how it feels to be so far from your home and family.
I went into my viewing with this crazy half-cock theory that maybe Costner wasn't being lazy or inept, but that Kevin freaking Costner, the heart and soul of the all-time great Field of Dreams, was being an ahead-of-his-time genius. You see, there's been a movement in the last decade or so, spearheaded by the Globe Theatre, to perform Shakespeare's plays in the accent that the actors in Elizabethan England would have used. So, here's actor Ben Crystal doing the opening of Romeo and Juliet in received pronunciation, the dropped R Queen's English that films have led us to believe every historical figure used, dating all the way back to Roman times, before there even was a language that would be remotely recognizable as today's English.
Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona where we lay our scene. From ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood lays civil hands unclean. From forth the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life, whose misadventured pitch...
And here's that same actor performing that same scene in the accent that we believe Shakespeare and his contemporaries would have actually used, based on things like Shakespeare's rhyme scheme, which modern pronunciation does have a tendency of breaking.
Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona where we lay our sin. From ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood lays civil hands unclean. From forth the fatal lines of theirs two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take the life, whose misadventured, piteous overthrows doth with their death bury their parents' strife.
This is mind-blowing stuff. In addition to restoring rhymes, it's quicker, lower, and, I don't know, saltier? Earthier? What we think of today as the British accent, in spite of the fact that there are so many different British accents, many of them displaying roticity, meaning that R's don't get dropped, that didn't flourish until over a century after Shakespeare died. So Queen Elizabeth I didn't sound like this.
I will have one mistress here, and no master!
Henry V's St. Crispin's Day speech did not sound like this.
We happy few. We band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother.
And King Arthur certainly didn't sound like this.
And there's a legal limit to the snow here in Camelot.
And Robin Hood, if he existed at the turn of the 13th century, most definitely did not sound like Cary Elwes laying this sick burn on Kevin Costner in Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
And why should the people listen to you?
Because, unlike some other Robin Hoods, I can speak with an English accent.
We've been lied to. So you can probably see where I was going with my Costner theory. I had this vague hope, having not seen Prince of Thieves before, that Costner had forfeited our expected, beloved, historical figure's British accent for something nearer to period accuracy. Maybe he had beat Ben Crystal and the Globe to the punch by a decade, saying, I'm gonna show people that Brits in 1194 would have sounded a lot more like Americans than people expect. Let's ask Errol Flynn what he thinks of my Costner theory. Now, I know, having seen the movie, that if Costner did think anything like that, he did not research Shakespeare's rhyme scheme, and he didn't tell anyone else in the cast to join him. Like, come on, Kevin. Drop a hint to Rickman that we're not doing RP.
Cancel the kitchen scraps for lepers and orphans. No more merciful beheadings. And call off Christmas.
It's much more likely, infinitely more likely, that Costner is just legendarily bad at accents. He was going for received pronunciation and landed on California dude making fun of Errol Flynn sometimes.
This is blood money, Marion. It's intended to bribe King Richard's enemies to unite against him.
I should say this in his defense, though. It's not like we have a lot of ground to stand on when it comes to accent work in Robin Hood films. We've tended to be remarkably accepting of strange accent choices in the past. Mel Brooks' Men in Tights joke at the expense of Costner works so well in part because Cary Elwes has such crisp elocution, while Dave Chappelle is being Dave Chappelle.
Hey, look, man, you don't have to do this. Look, this ain't exactly the Mississippi. I'm on one side, I'm on the other side.
In the most beloved Robin Hood film of all time, Friar Tuck sounds like some guy who was working on the Warner Brothers studio plumbing before he got thrown onto the jolly old England soundstage and told, go read some lines.
If you're a robber, you'll get nothing from me. I'm a Colonel Fry and vowed to poverty.
And then, of course, there's the Disney version with Fox Robin Hood, where half the characters sound like they're on the BBC.
Because I love him, Your Highness.
Love him? And does this prisoner return your love?
Marion, my darling, I love you more than life itself.
And the other half sound like they're in Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh, Sheriff, don't you reckon we'd ought to give that there trap door a test?
Criminally. Now I know why your mama called you Nutsy.
Heck, Shrek features a French-accented Robin Hood, which seems like a strange jump to make for a hero who's mostly been thought of in modern times as a Saxon noble fighting off Frenchmen from Normandy.
From the rich and beef to the needy.
It takes a wee percentage.
But I'm not greedy. I risk your pretty damsels. Man, I'm good.
Monsieur Who.
Take it down.
And then, there's the stuff we're not even necessarily aware of. So on top of the fact that we unconsciously expect historical characters to speak with a historical British accents, we also expect historical figures who never spoke a lick of English, or its 1190s equivalent, to sound like Sean Connery.
It is I who am honored, Lord Luxby. Thanks to you, I still have a throne.
Because of this, we think of King Richard the Lionheart, Richard of Anjou, who spent most of his life in modern-day France, Israel, and imprisoned in Austria, as none more English. A story has changed the way we see history. Richard's brother John may have had a better grasp of the English language, but he certainly did not sound like Claude Rains.
You'll be sorry you interfered.
Or Peter Ustinov.
I sentence you to sudden, instant, and even immediate death.
Or like Oscar Isaac doing really great accent work in the Russell Crowe Robin Hood, a film that strives for historical verisimilitude, except, I guess, for the part where the Plantagenet royals, Richard and John and their mom, Eleanor of Aquitaine, were very much not native speakers of English.
You, who honored your husband with 8 children, so that even now, when death has taken the rest, you have a king and the runt of the litter to call you mother.
But we love those performances because they are committed, and commitment matters. Commitment is what Costner's accent lacks. And commitment is what Rains and Isaacs and Ustinov's work has in spades. Even if they are committed to historical untruths, they're still immensely fun. Those performances are lived in. And because of that, because great performances aren't necessarily the most historically accurate performances, and because performance and storytelling are not the rote recapturing of facts, I wouldn't trade working-class American Friar Tuck or R-Rolling King John for anything, least of all historical verisimilitude. This episode, one of our most iconic stories, one that has been popular for centuries. A lot of people wonder if it's based on historical fact. Was there a real Robin Hood? But what I think we should be asking is, how much is history, the history we think we know, based on this story? Welcome back to Iconography, a podcast about the geography of icons, real and imagined. This episode, we're beginning a 3-episode journey into Sherwood Forest, one of England's most iconic imagined spaces. Except it's real. It's not what it used to be. Nottingham is definitely real, and Prince John definitely had a castle there. And his majestic brother Richard, who returned from his crusade in 1194 after a year and a half of imprisonment, was also real as real can be. But he didn't sneak back into the country and hang out in Sherwood Forest until he was ready to surprise his dastardly brother at the most dramatic moment possible. That's imagined. Fun, but imagined. As for Robin Hood and his merry men, who stole from the rich and gave to the poor, go ahead, make your case. You could probably convince someone they were either real, inspired by a real Robin or Robert and his band of outlaws, or that they were imagined, the fanciful yarns of a populace taken with a romance of the life of an outlaw. It's all enough to make one's head spin. You want to know what is real, though? I'll tell you. The effect that Robin Hood has had on history, and the reciprocal effect that history has had on him. What I want to do in this episode, as well as in the two episodes that follow it, is look at how the Robin Hood legend has altered the way we perceive the real historical period and real historical figures that it touches. And I want to look at how our perception of that historical period, the 1190s, the reign of King Richard, the Third Crusade, the lead up to the Magna Carta, how all of that has altered Robin Hood. In this episode, we'll see how Robin Hood changes across some of his most popular adaptations. Sir Walter Scott's novel Ivanhoe, which features Robin Hood, Richard, and John. The 1938 Technicolor Swashbuckler, starring Errol Flynn.
Greetings, Your Highness.
The 1972 countrified musical done by Walt Disney Animation.
And the taxes is due.
The aforementioned Prince of Thieves, starring Kevin Costner.
You'll have to fight me for it.
Love to, mate.
And Ridley Scott's sprawling origin story that reunited him with Gladiator star Russell Crowe. Next episode, we'll view King Richard through the lens of his recurring cameo in Robin Hood adaptations, and see how that contrasts with the real King Richard, who was not above doing some rather Prince John-like things. And then, in the wrap-up to this series, we'll see why his brother John was still much, much, much worse, as bad as his reputation, and why that might have actually been a gift to England in the long run. So here's the incredible thing about Richard and John as Robin Hood characters. Robin Hood has completely reshaped the reputations of these royal brothers in a relatively short span of time. For hundreds of years, they both had nothing to do with the Robin Hood legend. It is shocking the extent to which this is true. Today, if a Robin Hood film were set in the 1320s, over a century after Richard took a crossbow to the shoulder and John took the throne, it would be dinged for egregious inaccuracy. But if you had told someone in the late medieval period that Robin Hood had met King Richard in 1194, they would have told you you were getting the story very, very wrong, that you were off by 120-some-odd years. Something really changed in the interim. I am not understating the shock value. I, for instance, got quite the jolt when I had to rewrite this whole section. Yes, even after plenty of research, I'd forgotten to check when Robin Hood first started showing up. See, I assumed, quite smugly, that, I knew that John wasn't a character in the story until much later, but, come on, the Robin Hood folktale must have started making the rounds during his terrible, horrible, no good, very bad reign. This just seems natural, it seems right. You can imagine the peasants of King John's day complaining about their taxes and swapping stories about Robin Hood, champion of the Saxon poor, fighting the cruel noblemen of Normandy. Take it away, Errol.
I'll never rest until every Saxon in this shire can stand up, free men, and strike a blow for Richard and England.
This has had a really powerful effect on how we see this era. Prince John and his Norman supporters, the mice at play, while the cat's away at the crusade, roaring at the Saracens in the Holy Land. It's transformed the legacy of John, of course. He's become an irredeemable villain, or more of one than he already was, but it's also dramatically transformed the legacy of Richard. Because even when the facts are staring you in the face, Richard, a flawed man in his late 30s returning to Sandwich in March of 1194, the realm perfectly aware that their king was back, it's difficult to unsee something that's been seen so many times. The majestic, chivalrous old lion dramatically removing his disguise and bringing justice and love back to England with him. We'll examine the nuances of all of that next episode, but for now, let's just marvel at the fact that Richard's reign has been defined by a story that didn't sprout up until long after he was dead. It's like a story that tangentially involves Queen Elizabeth II inadvertently affecting the way that people of the future see Queen Victoria. So if the original Robin Hood stories had nothing to do with King Richard, during which king's reign were they set? In The Jest of Robin Hood, a multi-part ballad from the turn of the 16th century, the king that's so peeved by Robin actually gets a name. Thou shalt with me to Greenwood, without any lodging, till that I have get us grace of Edward, our comely king. There were a few Edwards in a row following King John and his son Henry III. A popular candidate for our forgotten man in the Robin Hood mythos is Edward II. That's King John's great-grandson and son of Edward Longshanks, nemesis of William Wallace. You're trying to picture Edward II now, aren't you? What did he do? When did he rule? Was he a good king? Was he in Braveheart? Yes, he was, and Mel Gibson did not do him any favors.
This Wallace is a brigand, nothing more.
And how would you deal with this brigand?
Like any common thief, have the local magistrate arrest him and punish him accordingly.
Wallace has already killed the magistrate and taken control of the town.
King John, who ruled a century earlier than Edward II, is so much more vivid in our minds. Why is that? Well, the answer's obvious. This has to be because every 20 years or so.
You, my friends, must collect in taxes not 2 gold marks in the pound, but 3.
Like clockwork.
Triple the taxes!
We see him pop up again.
So, taxation.
Standing in for oppression, unthinking taxation, and uneven distribution of wealth.
So you think you're overtaxed, eh?
Overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope.
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
The week I'm writing and recording this, Robin Hood has been in the news more than any 700-year-old man has the right to be. In the run-up to the UK snap elections, a so-called Robin Hood tax is being bandied about by the Labour Party. This would, according to Labour, force businesses in the City of London to pay their fair share.
Where they're speculating, the most risky speculation in derivatives, we want them to make a contribution. Just fair, a fair contribution, very
That's
small.
That's taking from the rich. Across the pond, comedian Dave Chappelle, whose first film role was Achu in Robin Hood Men in Tights, he made this apology for telling people to give Donald Trump a chance. And he did it at a fundraiser for the Robin Hood Foundation.
The Robin Hood Foundation combines investment principles and philanthropy to assist programs that target poverty in New York City.
That's giving to the poor. Who is Robin Hood more than half a millennia on from The Jest of Robin Hood? The Lincoln green outfit and the deaf skill with a bow and arrow are important, sure. But a costume and a party trick don't keep you relevant generation after generation after generation for centuries. Looking at a character Robin has inspired, DC's Green Arrow, I think it's pretty clear that what's even more important is a philosophy. Both the green and the arrow are obvious homages to Robin Hood, but it's an ideology that updates Robin Hood's outlaw spirit for the modern age that has really made Oliver Queen stand out in the comic book world. In a 1969 story arc that brought superhero comics kicking and screaming into the modern age, billionaire Oliver Queen lost his riches and became a crusader for the oppressed. DC superheroes in the Silver Age weren't the gruff vigilantes of today. They tended to work within the law, waiting for police to shoot off the bat signal that beckoned them. Oliver Queen represented a departure from that and signaled a new age for comics, the Bronze Age. Needing a foil that made a more radical outside-the-law approach seem necessary, Ollie was teamed with DC's other prominent green superhero. In the extremely influential series Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Green Lantern represented the hope that one could work within the system to build a better world. And Green Arrow was there to show this square that systems and laws that enforce privilege for the few over justice for the many don't deserve to be upheld. This is the arc that we see play out in our most familiar Robin Hood adaptations. Robin of Locksley returns from a long absence, or he checks his nobleman's privilege, or both. Either way, he sees things as they truly are, and he commits an act that puts him in direct conflict with the law, usually saving a starving peasant who's killed one of the king's deer.
That little bastard was poaching deer.
Poaching? Is it not a greater crime to starve a family?
He confronts the law face to face, and he sees that there is no viable avenue for positive change. And he's awakened to a world of corruption and injustice. And at some point, he gets up on a rock in Sherwood, and he tells the peasants who surround him that he sees their pain, and that together they will fight the system until it breaks.
Swear this oath. That you, the free men of this forest, swear to despoil the rich, only to give to the poor, to shelter the old and the helpless, to protect all women, rich or poor, Norman or Saxon. Swear to fight for a free England, to protect her loyally until the return of our king and sovereign, Richard the Lionheart. And swear to fight to the death against our oppressors.
Now, if you're starting to think that this whole idea of a peasant's revolt actually sounds remarkably modern, French Revolution, if not October Revolution, well, my friend, you've taken the red pill, and you're waking up on the other side. Now let me show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. It's not just John and Richard who joined the Robin Hood party late. No, the very core of Robin Hood, the code of ethics that defines him, was really only locked in during the reign of King George III. This guy.
Oceans rise, empires fall. We have seen each other through it all. And when push comes to shove, I will send a fully armed battalion to remind you of my love. Da, 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 da.
I want you to meet 18th century antiquarian Joseph Ritson, a conveyancer by trade, meaning he was transferring property from one person to another. He made his lasting mark as a historian focusing on English folk literature. When Ritson completely redefined Robin Hood, he was an extraordinarily disagreeable man in his 40s, likely suffering from symptoms that would eventually drive him insane. He was remarkably good at digging up old manuscripts, but was more famous, let's just go ahead and say infamous, for the tenacity with which he would absolutely tear into his contemporaries in the field of literary history. You can think of Ritson as a sort of Alan Lomax of pre-sound recording days, someone who would go out into the field and find the songs of the people before they disappeared. And this 18th century Lomax was not going to abide by anyone recording their own cover versions in lieu of faithfully recording the source. Anyone who Ritson thought had meddled with the original text of a manuscript before publishing it, whether that be polishing it up, beefing it up, modernizing it, that person was in the line of fire. One target along these lines was Bishop Thomas Percy, who had worked with Dr. Samuel Johnson, he of the famous text on Shakespeare and the even more famous early dictionary, to publish a volume called Relics of Ancient English Poetry, which included some early Robin Hood ballads. In a letter, Bishop Percy stated that Samuel Johnson promised to assist me in selecting the most valuable pieces and in revising the text of those he selected. Revising? Ah, hell no. Ritson spit fire all over Percy, of course, regarding one ballad which Percy nearly doubled in size, claiming that it was in so defective and mutilated a condition that it was necessary to supply several stanzas. Ritson spat back, "They, who supply so many of the stanzas, might without any great difficulty have supplied the whole." But he also did Percy one better. Ritson made it his mission to find every Robin Hood ballad, play, and story he could and publish them just as they were. The trouble with that is, not everything Ritson found in his grand search deserved to be preserved as historical. Some of it, like the plays of Shakespeare's contemporary Anthony Munday, had the sheen of history, but were just plain made up. The basis of Munday's plays, The Downfall of the Earl of Huntingdon and The Death of the Earl of Huntingdon, was that Robin Hood had been the Earl of Huntingdon, an ally of King Richard in the 1190s. Which is weird, because, as we've already established, the ballads we have record of definitely said that Edward was king, and also that Robin was a yeoman, decidedly middle class and not a nobleman. And it's also weird because the only possible claimant to the title Earl of Huntingdon named Robert in the 1190s would have been a baby. Look, maybe the message had changed between A Jest of Robin Hood and 1598. Maybe Munday had gotten the message wrong. Or maybe, like his crosstown rival Shakespeare, he was not a man to let history get in the way of a good yarn. Which brings us back to Ritson, our erstwhile 1790s antiquarian, who obviously did not edit the text he presented themselves. Heaven forfend. But he did present his editorial observations in a preface, as was the practice of the time. Samuel Johnson's preface to his collection of Shakespeare is world-renowned for both its praise and criticism of the bard. In Ritson's preface to Robin Hood, a collection of all the ancient poems, songs, and ballads now extant relative to that celebrated outlaw. Good title, Joseph. He combined all the texts he'd collected into a unifying theory of the real Robin Hood. And he was very clearly picking up what Anthony Munday was putting down. Robin Hood was born at Locksley in the county of Nottingham in the reign of King Henry II, and about the year of Christ 1160. His extraction was noble. He is frequently styled and commonly reputed to have been Earl of Huntingdon. Ritson goes further, showing a remarkable amount of creative license for someone who was so adamantly against creative license. With respect to Robin Hood's personal character...
His personal character? Did you have dinner with him, Joseph?
It is sufficiently evident he was active, brave, prudent, possessed of uncommon bodily strength and considerable military skill... Just, generous, benevolent, faithful, and beloved or revered by his followers and adherents for his excellent and amiable qualities. In these forests and with his company, he, for many years, reigned like an independent sovereign, a perpetual war, indeed, with the King of England and all his subjects, with an exception, however, of the poor and needy, and such as were desolate and oppressed or stood in need of his protection.
Starting to sound familiar, right? Now, I don't want to ding the Robin Hood of those medieval ballads too hard. He's a decent enough fella, and there are lines about him being, like, nice to the poor. But he and his merry men were outlaws, not protectors of the innocent. Not defenders of the one true king's crown like Errol Flynn and his pals.
Friends! What shall we do with this treasure? Divide it amongst ourselves?
Hold it for Richard! It belongs to the king!
The only redistribution of wealth that the medieval Robin Hood and Little John were doing was redistributing other people's money into their own satchels. This was romantic in its own way. Living outside the law as a rebel has an obvious romance. But it wasn't heroic. Essentially, before Ritson came along, people saw Robin Hood like Little John sees him in this exchange from the Disney film.
Rob? That's a naughty word. We never rob. We just... sort of borrow a bit from those who can afford it.
Borrow? Boy, are we in debt.
But Ritson, who was a massive fan of the French Revolution and couldn't really publicly express his anti-monarchical views in 1790s England, he found another outlet for his politics by saying, No, Robin Hood was a man of the people, a toppler of tyrants, a Robespierre with a bow and arrow. It is not to be concluded that he must have been guilty of manifest treason or rebellion, as he most certainly can be justly charged with neither. Robin's actions endeared him to the common people, whose cause he maintained for opposition to tyranny is the cause of the people. And in spite of the malicious endeavors of pitiful monks, by whom history was consecrated to the crimes and follies of titled ruffians and sainted idiots, to suppress all record of his virtuous acts will render his name immortal.
Ritson was getting another petty dig in at Percy here, of course, but, I mean, he wasn't wrong. Now, like Ritson, we all think of Robin Hood the way that Friar Tuck does when Robin's fretting about his outlaw life.
Oh, for heaven's sake, son, you're no outlaw. Why, someday you'll be called a great hero.
A hero? Did you hear that, Johnny? We've just been pardoned.
Joseph Ritson had some help in spreading his message. Many years after our spiteful antiquarian had barricaded himself in his bedroom and set all those manuscripts that he'd so diligently collected ablaze,
years after Ritson had died institutionalized in 1803. One of the few men who remembered him lovingly took up his torch. He had an honesty of principle about him, which, if it went to ridiculous extremities, was still respectable from the soundness of the foundation. That's Sir Walter Scott, who, in 1820, departed from his tendency to write historical epics about his native Scotland and wrote a 3-volume epic from the vantage point of an antiquarian, finding an old manuscript about the days of Robin of Locksley, King Richard, and Prince John. That epic, Ivanhoe, very clearly indebted to Scott's late friend Joseph Ritson, is a strange but intoxicating book. If I had to break it down into percentages, I'd say it's about 15% Saxons being huffy about Normans, and 15% Normans being absolute bastards, 30% people who are very clearly King Richard, Friar Tuck, and Robin Hood doing really cool stuff, while Scott refuses to identify them as such. Then there's about 15% where characters, not just the bad ones, but all of the characters, are being really anti-Semitic to the Jewish characters in the book. 10% the narrator lamenting how much it sucks that everyone was so anti-Semitic back then, and another 10% where the Jewish characters are being caricatured as greedy in really anti-Semitic ways anyway. And the remaining 5%, just a tiny little portion, is Ivanhoe actually doing anything. Dude spends Volume 1 in disguise, Volume 2 in a bed, and Volume 3 with King Richard being like, "Ugh, stop being such a wet blanket, Ivanhoe." A better name for this novel would have been, "Surprise, King Richard's been back for a week." Want to know a fun fact? The name Cedric had never existed before Ivanhoe. Ivanhoe's father in this book was named Cedric the Saxon. Now, Cerdic had been a Saxon name, C-E-R-D-I-C, but Scott misread it, and Cedric, this little bit of metathesis, which is the transposition of sounds or letters in a word, it became a popular name on the back of the book's popularity. And for similar reasons, you probably think that King Richard snuck back into the country after returning from the Third Crusade to hide from his scheming brother. Sure, you know he didn't go to Sherwood Forest and that the details in the movies aren't true per se, but they probably have their basis in truth, when, in fact, they don't. Richard returned to the port of Sandwich in the March of 1194, not in the guise of an abbot or a mass knight, but as King Richard. What Walter Scott did here is like the metathesis of history. We've seen the Normans and the Saxons of 1194 quarreling so many times, and we've seen the peasants bridling at John's taxes while the nobles kiss John's ring so many times, and we've seen Richard dramatically reveal his presence to a shocked John so many times that we assume that somewhere in there must be a kernel of truth. But in fact, pretty much any Robin Hood you see today isn't looking back at history where the nobles hated King John way more than the peasants did. No, it's looking back at Errol Flynn's Norman-Saxon-heavy film. And that film was immensely indebted to Ivanhoe. And its author, Sir Walter Scott, was indebted to Joseph Ritson, who was drinking Anthony Munday's Kool-Aid. And Anthony Munday, at the very beginning of this chain that changed the way we see a historical decade that preceded him by 4 centuries, was thinking God knows what when he decided that Robin was a 12th century nobleman. In a way, what you and I do unconsciously with Robin Hood is not all that different from what Joseph Ritson did when he lent equal historical weight to the oldest Robin Hood ballad he found and whatever Anthony Munday was thinking. We may not be as dedicated to seeking out every version of the story that ever existed as Ritson was, but like him, we use the versions we've seen and combine those with the historical record we're aware of, plus a dash of our own prejudices, let's be honest, to form a picture of the past. Having some of the details wrong in that picture, Richard, for instance, speaking the wrong language in an anachronistic accent, that doesn't make us silly or stupid. It just makes us susceptible, like Ritson was, to the sheer power of storytelling. On the whole, I think moviegoers are much savvier about taking based-on-a-true-story stories with a grain of salt than they get credit for. We know a dramatic flourish when we see one, and we know not to write it into our history homework. But some things, inevitably, slip through the cracks. Especially those things which seem plausible, which get represented enough times, and this one's really critical, which seem like things we want to believe. I should really stop picking on Prince of Thieves, but For very noble reasons, it's a perfect example of falling into this trap. The writers of that movie had their pick of any number of ageless characters to be Robin's most trusted friend in their film. They could have gone with Will Scarlet, like the Errol Flynn Robin Hood. He's been around since the mid-1400s. Or they could have used Friar Tuck, like Sir Walter Scott did in Ivanhoe, or Little John, like Disney's Robin Hood. Both of them go back to the 1400s as well. The minstrel Allan a Dale, he joined a bit later in the 1600s, but he'd have still been perfectly valid. And faced with all these great choices and more, the writers of Prince of Thieves went with the age-old character of Nasir the Muslim to be played by Morgan Freeman.
You are strange, Christian.
Now, unbeknownst to them, Nasir had been around since 1982, when ITV had done the Robin Hood series that the writers saw. Oops. When the stunt coordinator on Prince of Thieves, who happened to have also been the stunt coordinator for that British show, pointed out that Nasir was the intellectual property of people who were very much still alive, the character's name was changed to Azim. You can see why they made the mistake. When we see something in a Robin Hood story, we trust, without thinking too much about it, that it is very old. Maybe not true, but revealing something about old truths. And you can see why they wanted to make that mistake, too. Having Robin run around 1190s England with his Muslim friend reveals nothing about the truth of the 1190s, like, nothing. But it reveals everything about our own truths. We need Robin to be enlightened for him to be our hero. We've let our own perceptions of history change Robin Hood in the way that Ritson's anti-monarchical tendencies influenced his take. Icons do not survive unaltered by our own prejudices, or in this case, by our very modern hope that we completely lack prejudices and that our great heroes of the past did as well. Robin's relationship with the Crusades is one that we can actually see changing across our modern adaptations. In Ivanhoe, Sir Walter Scott may decry anti-Semitism in his own uniquely anti-Semitic way, but his portrayal of Moors lacks any nuance. They are menace incarnate. If King Richard has been in the wrong, it's not for religious reasons. It's for being a devil-may-care adventurer who left his kingdom for too long. The Errol Flynn version hasn't progressed all that much over a century later. The opening crawl says Richard is off fighting infidels in the Holy Land. And while Robin Hood condemns Richard's crusade, he doesn't do so on religious grounds.
Ah, then you blame Prince John.
No, I blame Richard. His task was here at home, defending his own people instead of deserting him to fight in foreign lands.
What, you condemn Holy Crusades?
Aye, I'll condemn anything that leaves the task of holding England for Richard to outlaws like me.
Disney's Robin Hood obviously doesn't have any references to Moors, Saracens, or the Muslim faith, but it does mention the crusade, turning Richard's quest into a throwaway joke.
Remember, it was your idea. I hypnotized him and...
I know. And sent him off on that crazy crusade.
And then, things finally start to get more introspective in the 90s with Costner's Robin lamenting the time he spent on crusade.
I should have been here. He called the crusades a foolish quest. Said it was vanity to force other men to our religion.
His newfound maturity after years as a prisoner of war seems shaded with the lessons learned from Vietnam. Still, this isn't going whole hog. When King Richard shows up at the end, everyone is extraordinarily reverent, and no one disses him.
I will not allow this wedding to proceed.
My lord.
Unless I am allowed to give the bride away. You look radiant.
That changes dramatically in Ridley Scott's 2010 Robin Hood. In that film, Robin starts out as an archer in King Richard's army. Richard, who happens to run into him, asks Robin what he's thought of his crusade.
What is your opinion on my crusade?
Will God be pleased with my sacrifice? No, he won't. Why do you say that?
The massacre at Akrasaya.
When you had us herd 2,500 Muslim men, women, and children together, the young woman at my feet, with her hands bound, she looked up at me. It wasn't fear in her eyes. It wasn't anger. It was only pity. She knew that when you gave the order, and our blades would descend upon their heads, that in that moment we would be godless. All of us.
I should say that this film is actually much better than I expected it to be based on its reputation. I mentioned at the top that Oscar Isaac as John is phenomenal, but the cast is strong across the board, including Crow, who gets dinged for being humorless, but he's actually quite funny and light on his feet in this role. The best thing about Ridley Scott's Robin Hood is also the worst thing about Ridley Scott's Robin Hood. It tries something different. It opens, not in 1194, but in 1199, with King Richard almost back from his crusade, which, as we know, is not quite right and is conflating Richard's French campaign with the crusade, but we'll get there next episode. You know things are going to be very different when Richard breathes his last within the first 20 minutes. We start with Richard losing the throne on account of death, rather than ending with him reclaiming it.
The king is dead. Long live the king.
Long live the king. Long live the king.
So where does the story go from there? There's an exciting sense of discovery as Ridley Scott bends and breaks the story we think we know. And he's drafting off real historical figures like Eleanor of Aquitaine and William Marshall to take the story in intriguing Lannister and Stark directions.
Taxation. Milking a dry udder gets you nothing but kicked off the milking stool.
Mother, spare me your farmyard memories. You have none, and I don't understand them.
About halfway through, as Robin, Will, Alan, John, and Tuck pull off their first Sherwood Forest heist, you're left thinking, my God, this is fun. Where will it go next? Unfortunately, the answer to that question is nowhere in particular. The film gets a little bit lost in the history book where it found William Marshall's name, and it decides that Robin, as part of his transformation into a champion of the people, should suggest the principles that will become the Magna Carta to the fledgling King John.
If your majesty were to offer justice, justice in the form of a charter of liberties, allowing every man to forage for his hearth, to be safe from conviction without cause, or prison without charge.
It's supposed to be really stirring, but it's sort of odd.
On the sweat of his own brow.
Well, anyway, they all go off and fight and defeat the King of France together, and John gets really jealous of how much everyone loves Robin, and so in his last scene, King John declares Robin Hood an outlaw while he burns the Magna Carta he's supposed to sign, which explains why he doesn't get around to signing it for another 16 years.
Now you come to me with this document, seeking to limit the authority given to me by God.
The film ends where most Robin Hood stories begin, with Robin leading his band in Sherwood Forest, ready to steal from the rich, and yeah, you know.
I know. Robin Hood will soon be here. He robs from the rich and he gives to the poor. Yo-ho, we go skipping tra-la through Sherwood Forest, helping the needy and the oppressed.
You kind of leave the film waiting for six or seven more scenes that will make it a complete story. But there is something, actually, to this dangling ending, this suggestion of an ongoing conflict. So I find that there's something ideologically unsettling about the modern Robin Hood story that Walter Scott laid out. I'm actually pretty certain that his close friend Joseph Ritson would have had some choice words had Ritson been alive to insult it. Let's take a look at it real quick. So, the conflict is brought to a close because King Richard returns.
Long live King Richard!
Friar Tuck, it appears that I now have an outlaw for an in-law.
Robin Hood can leave the outlaw's life behind and marry Maid Marian because the good king is back, the bad prince is exiled, and pardons are thrown around liberally.
And I further banish from my realm all injustices and oppressions which have burdened my people. And I pray that under my rule, Normans and Saxons alike will share the rights of Englishmen.
Yay! But what makes Richard the good king? As we'll see in the next episode, the real Richard wasn't all that in a bag of chips. Plus, considering what Robin was actually fighting against, taxation, inequality, forest laws that assume that God has set aside thousands of deer only for his chosen ruler, Robin Hood shouldn't be able to tolerate any king. Richard was guilty of all those things, even if he might have been a little nicer about it, as was his father before him, etc. It's weird and unsatisfying that a story about a man living outside the law because the system is inherently corrupt ends when that vigilante cedes the spotlight because, a more tolerable oppressor has come along. Even weirder is that we know what will happen in a few short years. Richard will die a warrior's death, and John, the bad guy, will take the throne and hold it for 17 rotten years. So, yay? In that light, what Ridley Scott does seems pretty genius. He inverts the structure. Richard's not great, but he'll do if he can get back home, and then he dies, just as the story kicks into gear. John is bratty and impetuous, but there is a brief glimmer of hope that he can be reasoned with.
I give my word that such a charter will be written on my mother's life, I swear.
And then the story ends on the note that history would have ordered it to in 1200. Specifically, these notes. But you know what? History isn't a story. Unless you want to get really philosophical, it doesn't have a solid beginning, middle, and end. It's all middle. Stories are important because they begin and end. Well, or they did before cinematic universes. There's a powerful symmetry to the arc that Walter Scott suggested and that Warner Brothers perfected in 1938. While history may not agree with the particulars, that story resonates because Richard, not the French-speaking 30-something who barely spent any of his reign in England, but the regal, old Lionheart, sneaks back into the country and hangs out with Robin Hood. It's not about his return giving the Merry Men permission to stop, because, at least he's not John. It's about the hope that the time he's spent with them has changed him into a better ruler, into someone who sees that every Englishman deserves those English dear. It's about a hope that a lawmaker can learn from the lawbreakers. History may not bear that out, but it's a story we need to hear, and one we like to hear more than ever, judging by our current craze for vigilante superheroes. And that's why accents don't actually matter all that much in Robin Hood movies, so long as they're not so inconsistent that they drive you nuts. Inaccurate accents, they create misconceptions. But any movie that's faithful to Joseph Ritson and Walter Scott's vision for Robin Hood will spawn misconceptions, because that vision was founded on misconceptions of its own. What's important is that Robin speaks to us as vividly as he spoke to the people of the late medieval period. Not that he speaks to us in the same words, or the same voice, or the same accent that he spoke to those people in, but with the same force. And that's why, as much of a mess as I think Disney's Robin Hood is, as much as I think it's lazily animated and lazily plotted, I have to give it immense credit for being such a powerful gateway to the Robin Hood mythos. There are some strange decisions, for sure, but I don't think that having a country star narrate the film, or having Baloo voice Little John, or having the Sheriff of Nottingham sound like the Sheriff of Green Acres is lazy pandering. I think it's brilliant pandering, a masterstroke. Disney knew its audience.
Oh, incidentally, I'm Alan Adeo, a minstrel. Oh, that's an early day folk singer. And my job is to tell it like it is, or was, or whatever.
Robin Hood, as the drunk revelers who dressed up as him for May Day saw him.
Robin Hood and Little John walking through the forest.
As the people who sang his ballads saw him, and as Joseph Ritson imagined him, shouldn't sound like an Eton drama recital any more than A Midsummer Night's Dream should. It should be fast and fun and salty and earthy. It should sound like the people sound, like real folk. And in 1972, Roger Miller sounded like real folk when he sang about the situation in Nottingham.
Every town has its ups and downs. Some towns' ups outnumber the downs, but not in Nottingham. I'm inclined to believe.
That's it for this episode. I'm Charles Gustine, and I write, edit, and produce Iconography myself. I sincerely hope you've enjoyed our romp through Sherwood Forest. If you have, do what Robin Hood would have done and help me out by going to iTunes and rating and reviewing the podcast. I'm pretty sure Joseph Ritson would have said that Robin Hood helps out small podcasts trying to get the word out, right? Yeah, I'm going to go with that. Coming in 3 weeks, we'll dig a lot deeper into one of our characters from this episode, King Richard the Lionheart. We'll talk about the time he tried to do exactly what his brother John did to him, depose a relative who was on the throne. We'll talk about the massacre at Acre. And yes, we'll talk about how Richard became more legend than man.